This podcast brought to you by Hope 103.2.
Power Lunch with Laura Bennett.
Hello, great to be back with you in this space for another week. And today we're getting to have an extended conversation with somebody that I've personally admired for a couple of years ago now. And as I get to learn more and more of he and his family's story, I just respect so much their bravery and their courage to do what they do. You might have heard of Jeremy Courtney. The name not necessarily familiar to many of us, but the work that he does is impacting the world in quite significant ways with his wife Jessica and their two children. Let me give you some of his context for just a moment. So when September 11 happened, we're going there, it took place in New York City and really marked an attack for a lot of people on the West, on the power of America, and it started to generate a real hate toward the Middle East. And even now, the cultural ramifications of that day are being felt worldwide. What's remarkable, though, is that while America was launching the war on terror, sending troops to the front line, Jeremy Courtney and his wife, they decided to take a different approach. They'd just graduated from university. They were a young, newlywed Christian couple wondering how they could really make their mark on the world. And in the aftermath of those terror attacks, they decided, get this, to go directly into Iraq with a message of love instead of fear. And looking back on it now, you'll hear Jeremy say how their approach was a little bit naive. They were wanting to go in there, yes, to love people, but also to convince them of a Western way of thinking, and ended up in this space where they were kind of angry at the reluctance of people to listen to what they had to say. But you'll also hear Jeremy talk about a shift in attitude that they had that helped them realize the value of the people and the viewpoints that they encountered, and what's now become the underlying ethos of their organization, Preemptive Love, which goes right into the front line of war zones, not only in Iraq, but Syria, Libya, beyond, offering relief and support. Jeremy's just released his new book, Love Anyway, which is part of our discussion today.
Thanks for having me.
Your story and that of your families is astounding. So we just need to start at the beginning for a moment. Why did you and your wife decide to move to Iraq in the first place?
Well, I'm American, and shortly after we graduated from university, got married, the attacks of September 11th on the World Trade Centers in New York City and our Department of Defense Pentagon building, and that's when all that took place. We had just been married, and I think, you know, a lot of the United States, a lot of the world was terrified by what was happening, the, you know, seemingly impenetrable United States was now under attack in a way that I think caused a lot of us some real fear. And that fear set into our hearts in many ways as well, as young people trying to find our place in the world, and ultimately kind of got us to start looking abroad at how we could be a part of that fear in many ways.
On the other side of a disaster like that, not many people would think, how can I jump into the mix and make this better and bridge the gap between American culture and that of the Middle East? In fact, it wasn't what a lot of people were doing. What compelled you to say, we're going to do something different?
Well, I think there, you know, to tell the whole story, there's a couple of stages of how this played out for us. I mean, before we landed in Iraq in the middle of the war, doing humanitarian work, trying to save lives, there was another stage before that. And, you know, I think we were well-intentioned in that earlier stage, but I don't think it was altogether good. In the earlier stage, the first stage of trying to play out our fear and do good in the world, I think, you know, we went out as Christian missionaries initially, and while some of that work can be good, I think in my heart and the way we did it, we did a lot of it with an intention to, you know, really make people be like us, make people see the world the way we saw it. I think it was missions work that was a part of the American project, part of the American empire in a way. And I think my intentions were as good as I knew how to be as one who was raised in that worldview. But I did have a big awakening while we were out in the world trying to live that life. I like literally heard the voice, saw the light, and kind of woke up to a whole new way of being. Gave up that project, gave up trying to make people be like me, and ended up moving into Iraq in the middle of the war, the height of the sectarian conflict, and just left all the other stuff behind, started over, and tried to see what we could do to start helping people, working on economic systems, working on emergency relief efforts for those who were caught in the line of fire. And that's kind of led us to where we are today.
And I mean, it would have been such a huge culture shock in simple terms to go from Texas into an area like that and that new way of living that you discovered. What did that look like?
Well, when I said that I saw the light, I was literally crying out in prayer to the God that I wanted to make everyone like us, basically. And in the course of crying out in prayer like that, I saw myself. I was actually kneeling down on the ground in prayer, and I was crying out to God in prayer, and I was essentially saying, why aren't you making everyone like me? Why aren't you converting everyone to my religion, my way of seeing the world? And I saw myself in my mind's eye with my fists up like a fighter. I was at once defensive and aggressive, throwing punches. And, you know, when I had set out after 9/11, I think I imagined myself as the peacemaker. Like, I had some other friends around me who they'd grab their guns and they went off to war properly. I was not like them. And when I had this see the light prayer kind of moment, I saw myself as a fighter for the first time. And I realized that, no, I'm a conqueror just the same. I've been trying to conquer everyone through my way of seeing the world, my way of being in the world. And as I'm crying out this prayer or whatever, this word or response kind of emerged. I don't know now if it was emerging from the heavens or if it was emerging from deep inside my own heart, you know, just kind of my psyche betraying me. But the word that I heard was, because you don't love them, Jeremy, that's why I'm not, you know, making you successful in this thing that you're trying to do. You don't love people. And when that word came, you don't love them, I literally saw it in my mind's eye, my fists lower from a position of fighting and aggression to an open-armed position of welcome and vulnerability and hospitality, open arms. And so that's how I would describe the shift. It went from a place of fighting and aggression to a place of service and welcome.
That is pretty profound, because when you go into a place that you are, at least initially, like you said, trying to make like your own world and make people see things your own way, to let that go is huge. And I imagine would have had a massive impact on the relationships that you built with local people. Tell us a little bit about the people that you have met and the way you have built relationship, because particularly back then and even now at times, a white American coming in, I mean, they would have had their hesitation to embrace you as well.
Yeah, 100%. And, you know, whether I approach it now from our work in Mexico or Syria or Iraq, I think that the principles are all the same, that people want to be understood on their own terms for who they are. They want the chance to educate you, not just to be educated by you. And that was a lot of it, was just coming to realize I've got a lot to learn. So friends like my friend Zito and his wife Marwa, they fled ISIS. ISIS came up from inside their village and from outside their village and attacked them and all the people who were a part of their ethnic group and their religious group, and committed genocide against them and their people. Mm. And they managed to escape. Their cousins, their own brothers and sisters and mom and dad did not escape. And we met them when they were on the run for their lives. And he was very in a very vulnerable place. They had literally nothing to their name except their children in tow and the clothes on their back. And we had all the power. We had all the money. We had all the agency. We had all the control. And yet over the course of these last 5 years together in friendship with them, he's taught us so much about love and life and forgiveness. He's welcomed us in. He's taught us about his religion. We've traveled together. And I think just learning to find mutuality, even where the cards may be stacked against us, learning to listen and be humble and kind of learning to embrace doubt, like the doubt that I may not have it all figured out, the doubt that I might be wrong, my country might be wrong, my politics might be wrong. That's been a really important part of the maturing process for me.
It's a significant picture of what it can look like to learn from somebody else and share your humanity in a very unique way. But in the book Love Anyway, you also share some of the times where things look ugly and dangerous and there's betrayal and all of those things that people fear quite a lot. How do you choose to keep loving people when you know that it might not change how they treat you and that you could still be hurt in a really deep way?
Yeah, I mean, all this, I wrote the book kind of on two levels. One, I wrote it to tell a story, sure, of what we've been through, but I was very mindful in writing it that I wanted to write a sort of guidebook for others, because I feel like many of us globally, as I travel, as I talk to friends, interact online, globally, it feels like a lot of us are trying to figure this stuff out right now. The world feels like it's being torn apart. Our neighborhoods feel like they're being isolated further and further from others. And we're all trying to answer this question. How do we survive? How do we protect our own? And how do we somehow be a meaningful part of a wider community, a bigger society? And I think a lot of that, from what I've seen on the front lines of war in Iraq and Syria and what our teams have seen in Libya or Iran, Mexico, beyond, we cannot bomb our way to peace. We cannot bomb ideas out of existence, whether those are religious ideas or political ideologies or cultural biases and bigotries. Mm. So the way that those things most typically get transformed, I believe, and I have experienced, is through relationship. It's through empathy. It's through coming to understand what it's like to live in someone else's skin. And so, you know, a lot of this preaches well or sounds nice at the like title of a book level or on a stage, but to be sure, when it's coming down to our own life and our own relationships, it can be really hard. And I think the hope of the book and the hope of the message is that, first and foremost, that we learn to relate to groups of people better, that we don't write off entire groups of people as our enemy. It's not just that religion that is at fault, or those people from that neighborhood or that ethnic group or that country or that political party. I think if we do better at the categorical level, that would be a huge improvement in our world today. And so we need to love people from different categories than our own anyway. And then the next layer, and admittedly the much harder layer, is at the individual level. How do we love the individual people who are from a different political party than we are? That's the daily practice, and I don't have a formula for that. I just know we have to keep working at it.
Yeah, you're doing it gradually, and I think it's important that you're honest about when it is tough, because if you do paint too glossy a picture, people who try to put it into practice will think, why isn't this working the way that I imagined? Exactly. So I appreciate the honesty in that. And as you're in America right now, you've come to Australia and spoken here. How has your relationship to the Western world shifted since being in Iraq? Because I imagine it would be almost either really hard to go back after coming to a place like this, or so easy to return because we all seem foolish and strange.
Yeah, I've gone through enough of these cycles now to understand kind of my own impulses, how to control those impulses a little better, and then to understand that I'm just part of a larger pattern of how many of us wake up and mature and evolve as we grow. So we're all born in a place, both geographically, culturally, with relation to faith and spirituality or religion or not, our politics. We all have this starting point, and then most of us either get stuck there or we wake up out of that place into something new. And that can be a waking up from conservatism to a more liberal position or vice versa. And what often happens when we move from that birthplace, stage one, to that waking up place, stage two, is we look back at our birthplace and we sort of curse the womb that gave us life, you know, like, how could you be so ignorant, stupid to raise me this way? I'm so smart and I'm so much better now than you all. And I've gone through that phase with regard to the United States, my Americanism, my whiteness, my faith, you know, my family, all of it. And it's ironic in some ways. Like I just woke up 5 minutes ago, but I'm going to posture in a very self-righteous way that I'm, you know, so much better than the rest of you. And, you know, I think on the other side of stage two, waking up is a more integrated place where you learn to bless the one who gave you life, bless the people who nurtured you and brought you up. You bless the place into which you've woken up, but you realize it doesn't necessarily have all the answers, and it can be guilty of a kind of fundamentalism as well. A kind of exclusivist or absolutist claims on the world. And I think what I want to live for, and the invitation of the book and the promise of the book, I believe, is that there's another thing out beyond that first waking up. And it's a more integrated place that doesn't live on the one-dimensional X-axis of moving from point A to point B, but it kind of moves into the three-dimensional Z-axis way of living, where you can actually live above it all on another level, and you embrace stage one and stage two, and yet you live in a sort of third place. Or you embrace conservatism and liberalism, and yet you still somehow don't allow yourself to be bounded in by the exclusivist claims of either one. And that's kind of how I've come to relate to my Americanness and the West and things like that as well.
Yeah, it sounds like you just have to have a complete openness to continue learning and to continue challenging your own viewpoints. And part of the starting place for you and your family is your Christian faith. And there'd be a lot of people, as we begin to really create a world that does embrace everybody, love everybody despite their differences, I feel like there'd be a group of Christians who ask the question, what happens to not just showing love and showing kindness, but also connecting people with Jesus and the importance of a relationship with him? What's your view on that now?
Yeah, I'd say it's changed a lot. I mean, I invested the whole first couple of years of my adult life out in the world trying to pretty well forced that to happen. And I guess my conclusion at the end of it all, well, there's been numerous conclusions, not least of which is we're not all even talking about the same Jesus. Like sometimes these words, be they God, Jesus, the Bible, Quran, Muhammad, whatever, like we don't even all necessarily have the same saying in view, despite what the text may say, despite what the tradition may say. We all are essentially still vulnerable to having our own experiences and interpretations. So a lot of it, I had to reach a certain place of humility, in as much as I realized I'm trying to force people into this thing, and I can't even be sure anymore that the way I'm interpreting this and the way I'm trying to enforce it or police it is universal, I guess, in a way that we're not all still somehow relating to Jesus, let's say, through a very particularized, personalized kind of lens. It's interesting. I haven't asked that in a while, so I haven't thought exactly how to respond to it. But maybe let me say this more to the point. I ultimately just had to surrender the idea that I can't make anyone be friends with anyone. Like, that's not how friendship works. That's not how relationship works. And I think through sheer force of will and argument and eloquence, I thought that I could, you know, win people over.
Right.
And it didn't prove to work out that way. And I think as I had that waking up, see the light, hear the voice kind of moment, it was very easy for me to move more into a place of humility and just say, look, I'm going to, I think what became more powerful to me was to live from my faith rather than spend so much time and energy trying to convince people of my faith.
Right. And let them see it in that kind of way. It's a very different, or not very different in a bad way, but it's a different way of looking at things that I think will make people really think. And on a completely other side of the conversation, living in the area that you do, there is that constant living in a way that you're questioning your own beliefs. There's the adrenaline of being in an environment that is affected by war and all of the stress, in a simple term, that comes with that. How do you actually look after yourself and your family? Because I feel like in the last decade or so, there can't have been many moments where you just get to put your feet up and take a deep breath.
Yeah. Well, the book is a bit of a Rorschach test, an ink blot test on how one might think of our life in that way. One could read the book and say, oh, these people do not engage in self-care and are unhealthy. And clearly this is a kind of toxic sort of environment. Another way of reading it, kind of depending on your bent, would be that, like, nothing will stop love, and love will go through any measure to care for others. And I think maybe both are true somehow at the same time. Jessica has said in a few public events, my wife, that we've done together recently, look, if we want to be able to help people who are in broken situations, we might just have to choose on some level to be willing to live broken. Mm. And that rang true for me the first time she said it, that there are some things that get broken in this work, and trauma is real. Trauma can be generational. There are neuroses and anxieties that can arise out of the things that we've experienced. And on some level, I absolutely believe they can be healed. And on some level, I also believe that even if they're not, pressing into other people's pain to be present to it and with them in it is worth that pain entering my own heart, worth that pain entering our own souls, lives, marriage, family. That's the price and the privilege of getting to do this kind of work and experience depth of love and light that I think we've gotten to be a part of in this life and work.
The more you do it, the greater your capacity probably becomes to actually,
I think that's right,
handle it all. Yeah. And I mean, you've got your two kids living there as well, a young boy, a young girl. It's incredible that you're able to do it as a unit like that. How would you describe their experience there? As a dad, it must make you so proud in some ways to see the way they're growing up compared to how you and your wife grew up.
That's interesting. I've never thought to quite make a direct comparison, but you're right. They're very, very much more aware of the world than either of us could have imagined being. We grew up just before internet and Facebook, you know, had completely taken over. And so they've got digital news. They've got access to stuff that we never had access to, but then in a more direct way, immediate, without the media standing between them, they've got these friends and these experiences of the world that were so foreign to me. I literally grew up watching Gulf War I, the invasion of Saddam's invasion of Kuwait and our pushback against that. I grew up watching that on TV. I remember very clearly sitting. That was my first exposure to the word Iraq and Iraqis and Kurds. And now these are their friends, and they know them firsthand and without any mediation between them. And that feels like a very profound full circle kind of reality. We were walking in Mexico a couple nights ago, and I had my hand on my son's back. We're doing a lot of immigration work in Mexico, and I had my hand on my son's back, and I could literally feel fear radiating off of him. I don't know, his shoulders were tense, and he wasn't responding to my touch the way he does when he's not afraid, you know? And I just asked him, what's going on? It was his first time in Mexico, and he just said, I'm afraid. And he's afraid because a lot of the culture that we come from in Texas has talked about Mexico in a certain way until this day. They talk about Mexicans in a certain way. These are these are scary people. This is the enemy. This is drug lords and cartels. And he thought, what with the way our families talk and religious communities around us and stuff talk, he thought we were going to be gunned down on the street by a cartel. And by the end of the week, walking down that same street a couple more times and having enjoyed ourselves and met real people and real friends, I looked over and one night walking down the street and he was just jovial and joking around and messing around. And I just thought, what can change in a week of firsthand experience when we get to know things without any mediation? We just get to have empathy directly with people.
Yeah.
It's profound.
And you must think, boy, you've grown up in Iraq. Don't be afraid of Mexico.
But that, I think that just goes to reinforce that it doesn't, it's not that our kids, it's not that we as adults just get singularly brave. It's that what we are is we're afraid of the unknown.
Right.
And so I still have fears as I stand on the North Korean border and contemplate getting inside. Like I have fears that I'll never make it back out alive. As I cross into certain places that we've been working, I still get very afraid. And there's no amount of living through pain or trauma or, you know, daring do that I think drives that out of our hearts forever. And if it does drive it out of our hearts forever, I think it's actually verging on a personality disorder in a way that we should not be able to drive fear out of our hearts altogether. I would not want that to be the message of our lives. I think the message is something more akin to, no, the fear will be there and the unknown will continue to be there. And it may even be scary as hell, as the subtitle of the book says, but we can discipline ourselves, coach ourselves, strengthen our muscles and our values to be the kind of people who love anyway.
It's so well said. And you mentioned that you have been right in the middle of things. You've seen the Syrian refugee crisis, the Iraqi refugee crisis firsthand. What do you think we do miss by being, I mean, for us here in Australia, looking on from a distance, what are we missing and not understanding about what's going on?
Well, there's a lot that could be said. Look, when our shores are surrounded by water or largely by water and we live in isolation, it can make us numb and dull to the realities that other people are going through. That's true of the United States. It's true of England. It can be true of Australia. So I think what we missed is a real sense of, there's a famous poem by I believe it's a Syrian or Afghan refugee that says something to the effect of, no one flees home unless home is the mouth of a shark, something like that. And it just, I wish I could remember it perfectly, but it's beautiful poetry. And for many of our friends, home has become the mouth of a shark, and it's not that they want to leave, but they have no choice except they would be devoured. And so I think what I've learned getting shot at, having bombs fall right nearby and having to duck for cover with shrapnel flying through the air, I have elected to go into those places, but I would not want to raise my kids in those places. And I think we just miss the empathy. We miss the golden rule. We miss the opportunity to do unto others the way we would want them to do unto us if we were the ones running for our lives.
It's important to see things through that lens. And I think you're right. We do miss so much by just being at a distance and not getting to see people face to face and the truth of what's going on in their eyes, you know. But as we finish up our conversation, Love Anyway truly is a story about, as the subtitle says, going beyond a world that's scary as hell. On the other side of preemptive love, what do you think the world looks like?
On the other side of preemptive love, I think there is a lot of agency. And the other side of preemptive love is not the absence of pain. It's not the absence of trauma. It's not that we always get to keep our lives. But the very word preemptive or the anywayness of love means we get to choose to love our enemies. We get to choose to take action even in the midst of conflict. The one thing our enemies can't take from us is our capacity to love anyway. And so really, love anyway, or preemptive love, it's about activating agency in our lives. And so on some level, I have learned this from my friends who have survived so much more than me, my friends who have had so much less power than me. I've learned it from the marginalized that it might not be too much to say there are no victims on the other side of preemptive love. Because on the other side of it all, if you are the one giving your life away, then they can't take it from you.
That's such a good way to put it, Jeremy. Thank you so much for everything that you and your family are doing in Iraq, and for writing the book, and for bringing all of this to our attention. You've certainly given us a lot to think about. So thank you so much for being on the show.
I appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
And that is it for this week's Power Lunch. Thank you for listening. Would love for you to subscribe, rate it, share it with your friends, and let me know what you think. Until next time, see you later.
Thanks for listening. Start your day with Life Words. Subscribe to Hope 1032's free daily email devotional at hope1032.com.au.